Court will now proceed to the fifth case, United States versus Selby. Mr. Gibbons.
Morning, Your Honor.
Morning.
May it please the Court, my name is Thomas Gibbons from the firm of Kreider & Gibbons. I'm court-appointed counsel for James Selby, the appellant. Mr. Selby was arrested after the police chased him and saw him throw a gun on a porch, and he was charged with being a felon in possession of a firearm. He was initially charged in state court. He was on parole, and he was in the state penitentiary. I think about 5 days after he was arrested, his girlfriend contacted the Internal Affairs, or OPS, whatever they call themselves now, and filed a report, a complaint alleging that the police had planted the gun on Mr. Selby and basically that he was framed by the police.
Now, in addition to enlisting the girlfriend to make the false claim that the gun was planted by the officers, it seems that he also instructed her to make a second false claim that she'd been harassed by the police for making the first false claim. So in combination, why wouldn't that be enough to conclude that he attempted to obstruct justice?
Well, after the police came to talk to her, she reported to him that she didn't want to have anything to do with this, that the police were pressuring her more or less, and that was when he said, well, go file another complaint. I think he has a propensity to complain to the police. It's not just on this occasion. If you read the report to the police, this is not the first time that he's done this. There was a prior incident as well. But the point is and the issue here, of course, is whether or not this constitutes obstruction of justice under the guidelines, 3C1.1. And I would maintain that it does not, and that Judge Guzman made the wrong decision here. And I say that because the complainant stated that she filed this complaint at his request, and the police couldn't interview him because he was incarcerated in Stateville. She told them that she wasn't present at the time these events took place. She indicated that she wasn't a witness. She refused to sign anything under oath. And basically, the complaint was withdrawn. The whole incident was terminated. I don't think the police remotely took this complaint seriously. And these type of material false statements, according to the commentary in this court's case law, are not the kind of conduct that constitute obstruction of justice. False statements made to the police, which are not under oath, have to significantly impede or obstruct the investigation in some way. And that just didn't happen here. The government, I think, conceded that below and then took a different tact and suggested that the defendant was trying to intimidate or influence the arresting officers into not testifying. And respectfully, I think this issue was sort of addressed by the district court in Ohio, where the judge said, come on, that's ridiculous, that arresting officers are not going to be intimidated by a defendant saying they planted the gun on me. And I would suggest that that makes sense. Otherwise, of course, in every case where a defendant says they planted the gun, the arresting officers wouldn't want to testify. There would be some kind of chilling effect. I don't think anybody took this seriously here. And I want to make 3 points about the government's argument about the attempting to influence or intimidate. The first point is that I don't think it was proven in any way that that was his intent. In other words, the government has the burden of proof in a case like this. They have not demonstrated in any way that he had a motive when he filed this to intimidate or influence the police officers. I mean, it's just as likely that he was vindictive, that he was angry, that he was venting. We don't know what his motive is. And secondly, it doesn't fit the case law where this type of conduct has been influencing or intimidating. All of the cases that this court has found that type of conduct have been where there's either been direct contact with the witness or some kind of indirect contact with the witness in an attempt to influence these witnesses. And thirdly, I think, realistically, there has to be some chance of success. I mean, as I indicated, nobody was going to take this scenario seriously. The police didn't take it seriously. They didn't even bother talking to him. And certainly they were not going to come to court because there was this allegation raised. And I would just like to make one more point here, and that is that really if this conduct here constitutes obstruction, then any time anyone files a complaint with the police, the obstruction enhancement would sort of automatically apply. And I would suggest to the court that that is a bad precedent to set. I mean, I'm not saying there aren't cases where it would apply, and I pointed out to Judge Guzman that, yes, if there was some evidence that there was collusion between the defendant and his girlfriend, that she would somehow make herself a witness or lie, I think maybe at that stage it would constitute obstruction. But we're nowhere near that in this situation here. This thing was totally dropped. It never came up again. The government themselves agreed initially that it didn't constitute obstruction. And this probation officer in her pre-sentence investigation was finding obstruction, and she was making a finding that the defendant had coached her to lie and to make her a witness, which was, there's no evidence of that. There's just nothing presented that would establish that. And even though probation officers recognized it, the new probation officer, and that the probation department themselves reversed their position by the time we got to the second hearing. So based upon all of that, I would suggest that there was no evidence here. And contrary to what Judge Guzman found, there was no evidence here that the defendant was trying to make his girlfriend a witness, or that he was trying to create a witness. There was no evidence that his girlfriend on cross-examination got cold feet. And for those reasons, I would suggest that the wrong decision was made here. I'm asking the court to find that this guideline should not have applied and to remand for resentencing under the correct guideline. I'm finished unless there's any questions. Thank you.
Ms. Beisenthal?
May it please the court, Bethany Beisenthal for the United States. In response to the arguments presented by defense counsel, first, the district court did not clearly err. The district court did not find that the defendant's conduct constituted merely a false statement to law enforcement. Instead, the district court found that the defendant's conduct in conjuring up a third party to lodge a complaint on his behalf was something more akin to the conduct that is considered covered by the guidelines, namely, in this case, witness tampering.
If we find that the government has to show a significant and actual obstruction under Hanhart, would the government concede that there was no significant...
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last part of that question.
What I'm wondering is if the government has to show a significant and actual obstruction under Hanhart,
mm-hmm.
or whether the government would concede that there was no significant obstruction here.
Thank you.
Your Honor, because that issue was not directly raised with the district court, and the district court was looking at this from the perspective of witness tampering and something beyond making a false statement, the record is not clear and developed as to whether there was a significant impediment to the investigation. However, the argument was raised during sentencing hearing that there was at least a very good chance that there would have been a significant impediment to the investigation, because when the complaint is lodged with the Chicago Police Department, an investigation is opened as to those particular police officers. At the time, then, that a decision is being made as to whether to prosecute, the attorneys who are in the position of making that decision are informed of the fact that there's an investigation pending against officers, and that obviously would weigh in their decision in determining whether to bring an investigation when two officers have this pending complaint filing against them. So while there is the record is not clear on that point, there certainly is the prospect of that happening in this particular case. That then goes into defense counsel's point about the district court in Ohio. The district court in Ohio, first of all, looked at the question of whether the statements in that case were false statements. The district court, after the appellate court had sent the case back to the district court, the district court believed that it was only permitted to look at whether that statement constituted a false statement. Then, in talking about whether those statements would have risen to the level of witness tampering, the district court found that on those very specific facts, there would have been no chance of success there. However, in this case, and as I've described, there is a chance that these witnesses are made vulnerable, that they're made unavailable because of the fact that there is an investigation pending against them.
You know, the district court found that this case was different from the usual claim by a defendant that a gun, you know, that the gun was planted, because in this instance, he had enlisted a credible third party to make the false accusation. What basis do you think we can conclude that she was credible? She seems like someone very willing to make a false report.
She does. And whether or not she's credible, the issue to the district court, it seemed, was that it was someone other than the defendant. So someone claiming to have knowledge.
Credible. I mean, he didn't just say, you know, you got someone. He said, you got someone credible.
And in using the word credible, I believe what he would be referring to is the fact that she's someone other than the defendant.
So anyone other than a defendant is credible?
Well, it adds additional credibility. When a defendant makes a statement, and I think that that's what's covered by the guidelines in saying that a mere false statement made by a defendant, say, I didn't do it, or it's not my gun, is something that's so typical. But having someone from the outside who would lend more credibility then to a defendant's statement that he didn't do it by adding that additional layer of saying the gun was planted.
So anytime a third person, you know, some psychopath comes along, they become credible? Or not they, he.
If they're enlisted.
If they're enlisted. But
what?
They're,
in other words, if the defendant.
If the defendant enlists them.
As opposed to a volunteer.
If the defendant enlists that individual and that individual
lies. Doesn't that make that individual less credible?
At that point, the Chicago Police Department, in this case, or in any case where a third party lodges a complaint, then investigates. And at that point, they determine whether that individual is, in fact, credible or not credible.
So your position is, even if it's dismissed at an early stage, the very fact that some resources are expended in examining the complaint, even if it's from an unreliable source, as Judge Rovner has described, you would say that that would be sufficient?
I think from the government's position, it's sufficient so long as the defendant attempted to engage in witness tampering
and to make that person credible.
Or to engage in something at least close to witness tampering, or to attempt to do that. Here, the district court found that this was something akin to witness tampering, which then doesn't require that it actually impeded the investigation. It requires that he attempted to do so, and that his attempt was to bring a third party who would lend more credibility to the claim that the gun had been planted on him. And if there are no further questions.
Well, I'll check. Judge Williams, do you have anything further?
No, I don't.
All right.
The government then would respectfully request that the court affirm the defendant's sentence.
Thank you. Mr. Gibbons?
Well, first of all, it's my recollection, and I could be wrong, that in the response of pleadings below, the government conceded that there was no significant impediment in the investigation. So I disagree with the government on that point. And I think the question here is, the government argued that he was conjuring up a third party to lie on his behalf. I would suggest there's nothing in the record, no proof that that occurred. He may have, there's something in the record that that indicates he had her file a complaint, which she indicated she had no personal knowledge of. But I don't think that's the same thing as suggesting that he was trying to conjure up a third party to lie on his behalf. There's nothing here, and I pointed out to Judge Guzman that there was collusion between them to make her an actual witness. And she quite clearly, the record affirmatively indicates that she from the get-go said she had no personal knowledge about this. And I think that to suggest that this could have had a significant impact on the investigation is nothing but speculation on the government's part. There was no pending complaint. They checked it out and they unfounded it. It wasn't like there was a formal investigation undertaken here, which under those circumstances may have had a chilling effect on the officers, but that's not what took place in this case. And I would agree once again that if she was making herself a witness, that would have some significance. And I would just like to point out that where is the proof that she has any credibility, as Judge Rovner pointed out? I mean, here she's his girlfriend. She's not a completely disinterested third party. She's a person who's acting on the defense behalf as his agent, is admittedly has a relationship with him. So I don't know how credible she is in any event. I think that under all those circumstances.
Do we want to encourage using the voice of a defendant, Mr. Gibbons, in settings where I didn't do it, it wasn't my gun, it was planted? Do we want to encourage as a policy that you can use a third person's voice even in an unfounded complaint?
No, of course not. But I don't think there's any distinction in this case between him personally making the complaint and using her, as the court puts it. He was incarcerated. He was in the stateful penitentiary. The record indicates, the police reports indicate that the police department didn't even bother to try and contact him because he was unavailable. And I think that's the point. I think that because he was incarcerated, he had her make the complaint. And that's just what happened here. She was just his conduit to make these statements, the kind of statements that defendants routinely and consistently make all the time. The police, I was framed, the police planted the gun on me. They just want to beef in hopes that something will happen. And I'm not saying it was honorable conduct. I think it is aggravating, as I pointed out to Judge Guzman. But it's the kind of conduct that this court has previously indicated can be dealt with within the applicable guideline range. I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thanks to all counsel. Ms. Gibbons, thank you additionally for accepting the appointment in this case.
Thank you.
All right. The case is taken under advisement.